time, we begin the thick net. I'm Limonk. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also hear Paul WS2N and John KC2WGB. The three guys that sort of do the net control on this thing. TechNet's been around for 30 years. And this is TechNet number 1448 of the series that began in September of 1982. The TechNet gathers people who have an interest in radio. That's really what the common denominator is, wireless techniques. That's how we got into ham radio, the magic of how you can, in one case, I had a transmitter on 10 gigs running on a 12-volt power supply. It could have been flashlight batteries, if you know what I mean, putting out 200 milliwatts and talked to a guy 380 miles away on a single drive band. When the band opens, and it opens some portion of every single day. Or your HF transmitter, let me drop. In some cases, it's a QRP transmitter running 5 watts into a simple wire antenna, dipole. You start sending out some Morse code, and the guy 10,000 miles away is talking to you. The magic of radio. How in the world does that signal go so far? Such a simple thing in some cases, seemingly simple thing. What does that radio wave really look like? Ham radio operators are people who just love radio, and they're curious. The real hams are curious people. Mankind makes most of its progress by way of curiosity. Those NASA scientists really wanted to know what's the temper and the air temperature and air pressure like on the surface of Mars. What's the gravity like? What's the wind like? And so we've got spirit and opportunity and curiosity, these other rovers walking around Mars, so to speak, making measurements and taking data. You got these spacecraft out there that are flying by Jupiter and Saturn and making all kinds of fancy pictures and measurements. You got the Hubble Space Telescope. Curiosity is where it's at. How did we get here? Where did it all come from? So the ham radio operators are mostly interested in how do I get the best antenna? How does it work? Best transmission line, best transmitter, best receiver. Do I have to spend a lot of money? How do I understand how all this stuff works? You got a lot of brain power in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. And by way of the other kinds of connections that KE2EJ and WA2CJ, WA2CDO. Now, you know what I mean. These guys have set up this particular repeater with both EchoLink and IRLP, and so now this particular repeater has a kind of an international connection. And so, in theory, people can sign it.
Repeater, time out.
In theory, people can sign in from very long distances away. You get the KTUPS, John, Rich, who will be driving his UPS truck through Indiana and Illinois and signing into the TechNet while in motion, if you know what I mean. So technology is really changing. These darn computers, you combine the right kind of a computer with the right kind of wireless network, boy, can you really do things. The technical net, I'll give you the menu as to what we do. People sign in at the beginning because they do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. The TechNet has existed for 30 years. By now, we believe somebody is listening. We've made that leap of faith. Those who sign in during that first hour, we try to run a schedule where for the first hour or hour and a half, we give those people at least a brief answer to their question. In theory, you don't have to wait any longer than that. After that, John goes to the mailbag for the people who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the equipment established. They can talk to us live. The TechNet is a live interchange on the spot. Written answers per se, with a few exceptions. So of the people who send snail mails and emails and whatever to John because they've got a question, we go through two or three of those that have a universal application. Let me drop. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, who tells us what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing, as well as European Space Agency and so on. So what's going on in space is an amazing amount of amateur radio operators with curiosity, and that's one of the cutting edges of science, what's going on in space. And so Paul brings us up to date on that. I'm very excited about this recent approval to begin construction of the 30-meter telescope. 30 meters, 98 feet in diameter. We used to think that the biggest thing that you could make in one piece of glass was the Mount Palomar 200-inch at 16 and a fraction feet. 98 feet. So that's what the 30-meter telescope is going to be operational somewhere around the year 2020. The European Space Agency is also proposing a 40-meter telescope made out of multiple individual reflectors, and so is 30-meter individual reflectors. As you build a bigger and bigger telescope, you see further and further in space, and you make more and more measurements, and you find more and more surprises. This universe is kind of complicated. One of the things I might get into a little bit later on is my opinions about running something like the Technical Net. This net is kind of unique. It's unique in about two or three ways. That is, it has 30 years of experience under the approximately the same leadership. Very unique. It runs for 4 hours for the last six or so years. 4 hours of people coming together with questions and answers for each other, helping each other out. Total number of hours on the air of the Technical Net is greater than the total number of hours on the air of Johnny Carson during his 30 years of running The Tonight Show. So that's a kind of a record as I see it. The Technical Net, by way of this application that was made by Alan, KC2RFN, was given the a national award. The Board of Directors, AROL, gave it the award for technical assistance in the year 2010. So we've been around a while, and I'm going to give you guys a few of my hints as to why it's successful. A part of it is because it is really a peer-reviewed kind of a science. By that I mean you have not only the three or four or five guys I mentioned earlier, you also have a very dedicated guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who has a website which is amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tv. You go there and the last 6.5 years of the TechNet are recorded. Choose the right year, the right month, the right day, the right weekend, so to speak, the right hour. Download that particular reel and you can hear what took place. By way of that feedback, we occasionally make mistakes. Everybody, every engineer has to accept the fact that he can't bat 1,000 when he drops. So we all make mistakes, and those mistakes do get corrected. Somebody tells us about that as time goes on. Okay. Well, as I said, I'll get into that a little bit later as to what I believe is required if you, in your particular town, country, state, want to run a TechNet.
Repeater. Time out.
As you can tell, this particular TechNet has a couple of unique properties to it. One is I, for one, when running it, run full duplex. In other words, I can hear what happens. Therefore, I know when I time out the machine, I can know when some of my words get covered up. I can also hear what's going on in the input continuously. So I'll get into some of those details. Okay, it's time for people to check in. I already heard twice somebody with a fairly weak signal. I'll get his call letters in a minute. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So give me those check-ins at this time. K2LIW listening. So last long, yes. Okay, whoever that was, you said it so fast, I got nothing out of it except the yes. Want to try again?
This is rather quick, didn't I? Got to beat the bunch. And to us, last long, yes. Good evening.
Okay, we got Mark. Who was the other person?
N2XGN, I wonder if you had a chance to go over the email, Time Crystal, just if I should log on a late hour.
Wes, N2XJN, you gave me 4 emails with a total of 10 websites to look at. You overloaded me. I started looking at the first one, which went on for an hour, and I knew that there was 9 more of them. You cut it back off a little bit, Wes. I don't know if we're going to get to your material or not. I did not. Sorry about that. Got to go a little bit slower. You got to decide to concentrate on one subject at a time, Wes. We can't handle 10 subjects at a time. I am limited. So we're going to try. Okay.
Just one more point.
Mark? Mark? Piece of by Faraday's law. In other words, the rate of change of magnetic field gives you some amount of volts, or the rate of change of those compound electrons. The rate of change of those compound electrons flying by is going to give you a whole lot of volts per meter. So the majority of the effect at any reasonable range you've got to worry about is how long is that conductor, how is it oriented, and whether or not it's protected. In the case of tube-type circuitry, where you get an instantaneous spike of voltage on something like a dipole antenna going into a tube receiver, they have tremendous survivability of that situation. If I, for a very brief period of time, put 1,000 volts on the grid of a tube, but it's only there for a few nanoseconds or a microsecond, the tube will sort of laugh at it for the most part. You do that to a transistor, a field effect transistor, a bipolar transistor, a diode, and quite possibly you've created damage. So it's the voltage pickup by the wiring, is my understanding, that creates the damage to the solid-state circuitry. There are protection circuits you can put in there. Pin diode-like circuits can give you a certain amount of protection. Super strong diodes back-to-back can give you a certain amount of protection. And so there are ways around this. Proper shielding and proper spike, or what's the word I'm looking for, instantaneous voltage coming into an antenna. You have to protect from that. So I'd like to believe that there are other people out there who've got more smarts than I do on the subject of a nuclear event and how to protect from it. If so, give us your call letters right now. KQLIW listening. Looks like the answer is no right now. There's a lot more to that story. But if you simply Google the word EMP, electromagnetic pulse, Google the word Compton electron, C-O-M-P-T-O-N, I think is the guy's name, Compton electron, nuclear event, you Google some of those words, guarantee you're going to find out a lot more information than I've given you. I've just given you what little I know, the top of the iceberg, so to speak, Mark. But it's not something to lose a whole lot of sleep over, because the number of nuclear events that you and I are going to suffer for the rest of our life, in my opinion, is very, very small. There was a discussion that took place on this repeater about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, in which a person was looking at the bombing that took place during the Gulf War, where you saw a photograph, you saw a motion picture taken from probably a helicopter, where a very lucky guy is Norman Schwarzkopf said, boy, is that a lucky guy. You watched him drive his Jeep across the bridge, and a couple of seconds after he left the bridge, a missile hit the bridge, and the bridge became vaporized. And the person was speculating that that was a nuclear event. Let me drop it. And I think there's a 99.9% probability that was not a nuclear event. In the case of a relatively minor war, like the Gulf War was by my standards, you don't use nuclear devices. You don't use a nuclear device until it's a really flat-out war, and all hell breaks loose, and you're sure you're going to lose your hold-on country. The highest priority that I know of in a war like that is you don't put nuclear devices on aircraft for fear that the aircraft is going to go down, end up in the wrong hands, and now that weapon that you put there is going to be something you've got to face. It takes an act of Congress to put a nuclear weapon on a war vehicle. You don't do that. So I guarantee that some of these super high energy explosives you've got these days will more than easily do that destruction that you saw, and that was nuclear. That was not nuclear. So do amateurs really have to protect from a nuclear event? I think the answer is no. If you want to be a super conservative person, yes, you're going to consider it. You're going to try to worry about what's the highest instantaneous voltage the antenna terminal of your rig can tolerate, and there are ways you can protect from that. And probably the biggest EMP you and I are ever going to experience, let me drop a quick.
By the way, Dick, you can also mention that you can convert to vacuum tube equipment, which is much more, much less sensitive to EMP than transistorized equipment are.
Who was that? Good piece of information. Who was that?
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo, name here is Gabe.
Good information, Gabe. What I was starting to say,
both Gabe and Mark, the biggest EMP you and I are ever going to experience, in my opinion, is lightning. If a lightning strike takes place within a mile or so of your house, even though you don't take the direct strike, that lightning bolt itself, on average, is 11,000 amperes for a few microseconds. That's a huge amount of current that makes a huge amount of pulse of magnetic field, and within a mile, every piece of wire within a mile is going to start picking up a significant amount of voltage. If that lightning strike takes place a mile from your house, you could probably feel some of it. If it takes place a block from your house, oh boy. I took a lightning strike, not directly on my tower. It hit the power line, probably within a couple of blocks of me. And the surge of voltage coming in my 110-volt circuit did a fair amount of damage to various things in my house, including the television set, computers, and whatever. And no damage to the ham radio equipment, which kind of amazed me. But to protect from EMP of lightning makes a whole lot of sense. To protect from EMP of a nuclear device, I doubt it. Unless we have another flat-out war like World War II, that's not going to take place, as I see it, Mark. So protecting from lightning is the right thing to do. Tubes can give you that extra protection if you want to use a tube front end to your rig. Another attitude is that you can put various protection devices. Let me drop a call. You can put various protection devices on your transmitter. And the other attitude is that, hey, the front end transistor on your rig, which possibly is going to get fried in a worst case event, it probably has a value of a couple of dollars. We amateurs are extremely good at repairing our equipment. And even if you're afraid to open the cabinet, you go to Andy, the B2CDL, who can repair almost anything. He's the guy who runs the repair clinic, or the clinic where you can test the amount of deviation you've got, the amount of PLs, whatever, at any of the Limog functions. And you bring your rig up to Andy, and you hand it to him, and he puts it on his service monitor and tells you the health of your particular piece of equipment. So with the help of Andy, the front-end transistor that's going to get fried in the worst-case event, it can be replaced. It's not the end of the world. So, as I said, don't lose a lot of sleep around this one. The guy I know of who has suffered the most amount of EMP from lightning was Glenn, KCQQIQ, who lived in Florida. I'm trying to think of the name of the town right now. The lightning capital of the United States is a particular town in Florida. I can't think of the name of it. He lived near that town, and he experienced, every single day was a thunderstorm, if you know what I mean, and some of them are going to get you. And the things that Glenn had to do to protect his equipment is a good story to listen to.
KCQQIQ, to comment on that?
Right. There's the man himself. Glenn, what was the name of the town that I'm trying to think of in Florida? Gainesville. Gainesville, Florida is considered the lightning capital of the world, and I think you were in a small distance from Gainesville, weren't you, Glenn? KCQQIQ? Go right ahead. KQRW and TechNet.
Probably on YouTube.
Yeah, the town I was living in, Dick, was Flagler County, Flagler Beach, Florida. And there was a tremendous amount of lightning there. And what's interesting is that I didn't lose any amateur equipment or anything like that. The most problem I had was with telephones, television sets, and the majority of that equipment was actually could be protected through the wall outlet, generally with something like a TFI device or those kinds of things as far as lightning goes. But on the other side of the picture, EMP is a lot more than just electrostatic pulses. There's other things that you have to worry about. Let me let it drop. For rad hardening, the two most difficult things to protect from radiation hardening is optocouplers, optocoupling devices, and EEPROMs. And the reason there is because basically when the bomb goes off, it puts off something like a X-ray / light wave that comes out of from where the explosion is located. And that light actually will blind and burn out the optocouplers, video cameras, or any kind of like, if all the cameras that are out there on the street for traffic lights, they'll be completely blind. Video cameras outside, they'll be blind. Optocouplers will be blind. Non-recoverably blind. And also anything that has those those light reprogrammable EEPROMs, some of the older cars, older equipment, where you would program an EEPROM with light,
those will all be completely erased and or possibly destroyed. Back to you, Dick. K2IW, K2QIQ.
One quick question on that one, Glenn. They're very vulnerable. Is there any good way of protecting them you know of, other than not using them? In some cases, we've got to use them. Is there any general technique you know of for protecting them away from the void beams, which I didn't do? You got it, Glenn. K2LAW.
Thank you, sir.
Well, as far as I know, Dick, that generally the protection against that kind of an attack, I think from, like, say, the military's point of view or first responders' point of view, is that you don't use them at all. So, in other words, they wouldn't be responding with equipment that had EEPROMs, optic couplers, or any kind of video-sensitive devices, any kind of video sensors, those kinds of transducers that are affected mainly by light and X-ray. They could be overpowered and destroyed. But generally, transistors, MOSFETs, radios, receivers, most of that stuff will really survive. But there's really not a lot, because generally, if you covered it with enough shielding equipment, those devices won't work anyway. There really isn't a lot you can do, Dick. K2RW, K2QIQ.
Okay, we have to accept the fact that certain kinds of components are going to be very vulnerable. You might have to avoid using them. On the subject of nuclear protection, on that particular subject, Wes, is that what you're saying? You have some information for us. And to XJN, K2RW and the Tech Man.
Always a certain knowledge that's associated with it, and it's not really the EMP, because starting from the pure photon that would be the gamma radiation down, we're using photons, and photon is the pure energy by itself without the mass. But then if you say what should be afraid for, well, which component are we talking about? As far as I can go. So we're talking about the alpha. Well, the alpha is the matter, and it's huge. So the alpha particles don't travel far. Even in atomic blast, the alpha particles spread is not great. In the normal circumstances from radioactive materials, you have a few meters to a maximum a centimeter or 2 centimeters of decay, depends from, of course, the source. But then, when alpha particles strike something, it creates a X-ray. The energy is huge. Let me go. Then we have a beta particle. Well, there is always something that is associated with it. Whenever we have the emission, at least we have to know what emission is it. Do we have emission of electrons? Do we have emission of protons? Do we have emission of neutrons? And then based on that, we could know what could affect our devices. So if you know that alpha particles create as the effect X-ray, the X-ray could damage the EEPROM. But the piece of paper stops the alpha particles, or the beta particles, a piece of plastic could stop it, or a very thin piece of metal could stop it. But again, because this is the mass, and then we have a certain mass number, two protons to neutrons, let's say, in alpha particles, right? Then if we don't think about the beta, any effect of it, what do we have? Well, depends from the situation, we have X-ray. So it looks like X-ray is the most common effect of any radiation at all. Of course, we may have a beta as well. But then when we go into the beta, we don't deal with matter any longer. There is no matter. With gamma. When we go into gamma, we deal with photon by itself, a pure photon of a photon. So now, we're trying to understand it by this. What is the energetic level of it? So the thing...
therefore, the impact or danger to the person doesn't come really from the fact that we have a gamma radiation or any kind of radiation. It comes from the fact what is the energetic level of it in terms of the cobalt.
I'm going to have to interrupt you, Wes. The main question that Mark was asking is, what can he do to
repeat your timeout?
S is overmodulated again.
Yeah, so the main thing we have to worry about is what can Mark do to protect from his... he's trying to understand it. And as I see it, the nuclear events, Mark, are going to be extremely rare from now on, in my opinion. Most of the major countries in the world are doing their darndest to make sure that the terrorists don't get nuclear devices into their hands. It does require a lot of technology to get the raw materials and the right delivery system and whatever. So as I see it, the main thing you and I have to worry about as ham radio operators is the EMP of a lightning strike or the extra pulse of energy that comes into the 110-volt line. That's what affects most of our equipment.
But I was trying to say, I was trying to get to the end of it. The only damage that is happening not from EMP is from the relaxation. In the process of relaxation, the power is accumulated. That's what is the biggest problem. So what he can do? He can do nothing. Because it depends on how close he is or whatever is the origin of it. It doesn't have to be the nuclear blast, and he can get his device damaged just because there is an X-ray radiation. And the only one that's left over is neutron that I didn't have a chance to get into it. Enter it here.
Who is the person who just said my name?
And to us, hello.
Go right ahead, Mark.
Thank you much. Actually, the conversation started with the that lunatic in North Korea. And they started talking about the pulse and that, you know, if your equipment is turned off, like your TV or your radio or whatever, it's affected. And I wasn't sure what the answer was. Then I got swung over to automobiles, and if, you know, all the computers would have been shot, and the only cars that would be running was the old-style cars.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, during the timeout, I was hearing Mark on the input, and he was asking if the equipment is turned off. And I think the amount of protection you get when the equipment turned off is minor. When it comes to front-end damage, because the antenna picks up a big voltage, and that's applied to the first transistor of your receiver, turned on or turned off, it's going to make a minor difference as to the damage. When it comes to the spike coming in the 110-volt line, yes, turned off is going to protect you from that, up to a point. That switch you got that's doing the on-off function on your radio has a certain gap size in there. A few thousandths of an inch when it's in the off mode. You get a high enough voltage on your 110-volt line, it'll just jump that gap, and the rig will act like it's on, even though you've turned it off. The guys who really care about protecting their equipment because they live in a high-lightning area, they don't just turn it off. They unplug it. They don't just try to put protection devices on the antennas. They unplug the coax cable. So, Glenn, I'm going to turn it back over to Glenn, and I'm going to ask him... when he knew a lightning storm was coming to his town in Florida, I'll bet you he unplugged the rigs, I bet you he unplugged the coax cables in order to do some of the protection. Is that true, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the tech man.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. In the beginning, the key offender was the wall outlets. And the amount of equipment, TVs and telephones, that I would lose were just incredible. It would, you know, I'd go to work, and when I came home, all the telephones were dead. The any wall warts that were plugged in were usually fried, you know, and not all at once. You know, it'd be like one here, one there kind of a thing, you know. So unplugging them was definitely a pain in the neck, but it was the only way I could kind of guarantee that when I came home at night after the storms were usually in the early afternoon while I was at work, so I wasn't really there to see it happening. Later, what I found is by just replacing the wall outlets with ground fault interrupters, GFIs, took care of all the problems and didn't lose anything really after that. Back to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, run that by again. If I'm going to get, let me pick a number, a 10,000 volt spike on the 110 volt line, which when coupled to my equipment is capable of giving me quite a bit of damage, and the GFI, you think the GFI can protect from that, Glenn? Yeah, run that by again. I'm a little bit amazed that that's true. Over to you, Glenn. K2LAW.
Yeah, apparently the way that most of these impulses hit with lightning strikes are they sneak down the power line of one side to the chassis. So what will happen is you get a lifting effect, and what generally happens is with the ground fault interrupters that there's just enough leakage current that goes between the hot side, the line side, to the neutral, that it basically just kicks the ground fault interrupter and completely shuts off the outlet. So when you come home, you see it, the equipment is off, and you're like, uh-oh, I lost it again. And then you just hit the test reset button, power comes back on, and the device is saved. So the order, maybe I never lost anything after that. I'm not saying it's guaranteed that it would save everything, but I would suggest that if you do have that kind of problem and you're worried about it, by using the ground fault interrupter will save a lot of equipment that, especially on equipment that you think is sensitive, like television sets, telephones, were the main concern most of the time.
Question for Glenn.
John recognized. Glenn, a quick question. After the GFIs were installed and most of your equipment got saved, did you still disconnect the antennas to the ham equipment to protect from lightning coming down that antenna? Wait for the beeps. Go ahead, Glenn.
Oddly enough, Dick, I never lost any amateur equipment in any of these storms. And I think the reasoning there was because I had them unplugged, in which they weren't plugged in. So there really wasn't a path through the wall outlet. And then eventually I wound up using GFIs even for the amateur radio equipment. So I never really lost anything with the antennas. And there again, too, I did a lot of the grounding on the outside of the house. So never really had a problem with amateur radio equipment. It was mainly things that were attached to telephones or cable lines. Those were the ones that gave me the most havoc.
Interesting. Go ahead, John. KC2WTB. KC2LAW.
KC2WTB. Dick, I'd like to know if Glenn lost any GFIs. That would be a good indication. How about it, Glenn?
Funny you asked, John. Yes, occasionally. I wouldn't lose the equipment anymore, but I did lose GFIs, absolutely. They were ones that maybe after two or three hits, so to speak, wouldn't reset anymore. So it wasn't like they went on fire or anything. It wasn't ugly. But, you just try to reset the button, and they wouldn't come back on anymore, no matter what you did. And usually it was like three or four hits, you know. And in the summer there, it wasn't that unusual. You could have one every afternoon for for a while. So, but didn't mean that those would trip every time. But I have replaced a handful of GFI outlets, John. Back to you, Dick. K2IWKC2QIQ.
I have a question. If EMP is present during, let's say, the nuclear explosion, or any such event, if you feel just the electric part of it, would then the magnetic component be able to damage the member of the device, say?
Okay. EMP makes primarily a lot of voltage on each conductor. You could say because of the magnetic field. The magnetic field is a major mechanism of conducting a voltage, of creating a voltage on a piece of wire. Glenn, my curiosity is such that when I had a GFI fail, particularly when you've had quite a number of them fail, I'd be tempted to take it apart to find out what failed. Not because I'm going to make any change to the design, just out of curiosity. Did anybody you know ever take apart a failed GFI that failed because of a lightning event? It's kind of nice to know what is the mechanism of failure, if you happen to know. Over to you, Glenn. K2LAW.
I had taken them apart, but it was nothing conclusive, Dick. It was hard for me to tell because there was nothing burned up inside there that I could see. The ground connection was still good. The plastic looked still in pretty good shape. It looks more like whatever happened created some kind of like a mechanical jamming is what it looked like. But here again, this is more, you know, trying to dissect it because nothing was like really burned up. It just was like as if there was like kind of like a spring and catch mechanism in there, and it just wouldn't, you know, reset and press back in. So it looked like mechanical failure, but I don't really have a good answer for that one, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
As you can tell, I guess that Glenn is a curious guy. I guess that he would have taken apart the GFIs, and sure enough, he did. You've asked a fascinating question, Mark. I know we haven't got the whole answer, but I think we've got a little more of the information here tonight. And to FLF or any other bill, take your rally to the image.
Quite interesting indeed. Seems that there's more to it than meets the eye. Okay, thank you, Dick, and the boys out there. Appreciate it. And over to you, Dick, and to FLF.
Yeah, I think in future weeks we're going to find out even more about that subject. There's a lot to it. Let's see, Mel, I think with the next night, K2 Mike Juliet, if I got it correctly. Go right ahead, Mel. K2RIW.
K2MC, Kilo 2 Mike Charlie, but you do have the name correct. What I have tonight is not necessarily, strictly speaking, a technical question. It's more a matter of, I'm contemplating buying one of these generators that's being sold by Harbor Freight. I forget the name of it, but be that as it may. They're considerably less expensive than some of the more well-known makes. I'm just wondering if anybody on the net has any experience with any generators and whether they would recommend it or otherwise. The one I'm thinking of is 7 kilowatts, got electric start, and it's relatively attractive price compared to others. That's part one, and part two would not be a question, but just a comment on the use of generators, which is sort of in line with some of the previous conversations pertaining to carrying of electrical components. So back to you, then. Back to you, Rich.
Hey, you sounded like you were a little bit embarrassed to ask that question, Mel. No, you got a darn good question. After Superstorm Store Sandy and Irene the year before that, and quite a few years further back, Hurricane Gloria, standby generators for a house, an extremely appropriate problem, question, subject to be discussed. We amateurs pride ourselves on having charged batteries and automobiles that we can connect to our electronics. We have all kinds of ways of making sure that we can continue to communicate. When Con Ed and LIPA and New Jersey Power and Light and all these other situations cease to exist, there's at least two or three different philosophies on this one, as I see it. Now, let's go a little bit further than your question, and that is, there's two classes of people that make a decision that's going to put a standby generator, motor generator set in their house. Let me drop. One guy thinks that money is no object. He wants to be super conservative. He adds up all of the appliances in his house, and he says, I want all of them to run. And he comes to the conclusion, I got to have a 13 kilowatt generator. That's one kind of guy. That particular guy, he certainly can buy a generator that's large enough. And if he's smart enough, he's operating it outdoors, further, far enough away from the house to make sure that the carbon monoxide coming out of it doesn't get back into the house. He's got some kind of a heavy-duty cord that goes from that generator, hopefully to a transfer relay in the house. In some cases, he's backfeeding the house. I do that. And there's a lot of disadvantages. But what I'm getting at is, he buys a generator such that he lives in the lamp of luxury during the time that the power goes out, and the people in the house can run every single appliance. And boy, that sounds good. Oh boy, does he run into a problem. That generator is using up a gallon of fuel every hour and a half, and so he's burning up numbers like 13 gallons of fuel per day. He's got a limited supply at his house,
Now he's standing on a gas line trying to refill the can so they can keep the generator running. He runs into that problem. You don't want to store a zillion gallons of gas on your property because it's got all kinds of dangers. But if you don't store enough gas, and now where do you get it during the time when many of the gas stations don't have power and they can't pump in this great big long line? Let me drop it. The other philosophy is the philosophy that Dave and N2APG took. He bought something in the vicinity of a 1 kilowatt generator. That 1 kilowatt generator, as he calls it, sips gasoline at the rate of 1.5 gallons per 24-hour day. So he is really conservative on the gas, and he's only got a kilowatt of output. A kilowatt of output, as long as he plays power czar, he can decide what in the house he's going to turn on. He turns on the furnace for a while. He turns on the refrigerator for a while. He runs the television set sometimes simultaneously. But he doesn't try to run everything at once. Now, we only have, on average, a couple of days per year in which you have an interruption of electrical power in the average year. And during those couple of days, he's willing to live a Spartan experience where, as long as he can keep his food cold in the refrigerator so it's not spoiling, as long as he can run his furnace in the wintertime and the hot water heater, he's got enough of the luxuries, and he's doing a little bit of camping out in his house. And when it comes to the electrical interconnections required for a 1 kilowatt generator versus a 14 kilowatt generator, there's a huge difference in the amount of rigmarole, the amount of cost, and the amount of difficulty of doing it. So there's at least two different philosophies along those lines. But your main question you asked is the 7 kilowatt Harbor Freight generator. Has anyone bought it? Are you happy with it, or you're unhappy with it? I've been to Harbor Freight. Let me drop. I've been to Harbor Freight about 4 or 5 times during the last year and a half, bought all kinds of things, and I'm extremely happy with them. I don't think they make a bad product from my experience. I bought lots of stuff from them recently, and as I said, I'm quite happy. So when it comes to the 7-kilowatt generator, which is getting a little bit beyond the smart kind, you're getting into the area where the number of gallons per 24 hours is going to be considerable, and now where's the gas going to come from? You're going to be siphoning it from the car. And by the way, even siphoning the gas from the car sounds good until you've really done it. Many of our automobiles have got the spring-like device down the filler tube to make sure that people are not unauthorized people siphoning gas from your car. So do you have the ability to siphon gas from your car? It's something, until you try it, you might find out with great disappointment that you don't have that, if you know what I mean. So the 7-kilowatt Harbor Freight, anybody have any experience with it, even secondhand, give us your call letters right now. KQRIW and the Tech Man.
KQQIQ.
Well recognized, and is there anyone else?
3JIW comment also. JIW.
And to APG. And APG, so we got JIW, the guys from the Golden Horseshoe up there in Canada, and APG. Dave, all right, in that order. Glenn, first, KC2QIQ. Tell us what you know on the subject, Glenn.
Yeah, I have two generators, Dick, that I bought from Harbor Freight. One was a 5-kilowatt, the other one was 7.5. Both of them very good generators in terms of low cost, pretty reliable. They're not too bad to start. They start pretty easily, but there's a downside to them. One of them is the first thing that you had mentioned. They're not very efficient on fuel. They slurp down the fuel real fast. So in a few hours, you'll be filling that thing right back up again, and you got to have a lot of standby gas to keep that thing rolling. So those are the disadvantages. One is disadvantage number one. The other disadvantage, those two particular generators, the 5 and the 7.5 kWs, that they are pretty loud. So, you want to keep them as far away from the house as possible. Even feeding cords back into the house and other things, they're just darn loud. You wouldn't want to leave them running at nighttime, mainly because the amount of fuel they're going to chew up, and they're going to wake up the neighborhood, so to speak. Let me let drop for a second. When you get into the more expensive generators, when you get into the Hondas and some of the other nicer ones, the first thing that you notice is the generators get quiet. They're not as loud. And the other thing too is the fuel consumption gets a lot better. So as dollars for the generator go up, typically they get quieter and a lot more fuel efficient. And then, of course, then there's the other alternative, which is running it off of natural gas. You can have a permanent installation mounted on a natural gas feed, and you'll have all the power you want, very efficient, clean operating, and there, in case the power goes down, it'll power up everything in your house as if nothing happened. Now, back to you, Dick. K2IW, K2QIQ.
W2BMP with a comment.
BMP recognized. There's two guys ahead of you, so stand by. We're going to get to you. Good information, Glenn, and thank you. Okay, the next guy was Jim, I think it was, V3JIW. Up there, as I said, I'm guessing you live in the Golden Horseshoe area of Canada. Is that true, Jim? V3JIW, K2RIW in the deck, man.
So this is V3JIW. Nice trip. I think I've walked right after you. I'm going to let it draw. Everything drop. I do. I live in with Gordon Horseshoe, but I'm very close to the center of Toronto by 5 miles. I'm 2 miles north of Lake Ontario. I really doubt any engine can run an hour and a half, a gallon and a half in a day, and I wonder what the BTUs are in gallons of gasoline. You work that backwards. You know, so 30% efficiency, you'd see 7,800 watts for horsepower or calories, whatever. Yes, some engines are going to be very efficient. When they're idling, when they're using small power. I've looked, by the way, when you look at a big generator, look very carefully at the circuit or the output. There's a 9.5 kilowatt generator. Yes, the total is 9.5. There's two or three unconnected separate power sources, like you've got, 3,000, 4,500, 2,500 in three circuits. You don't have one 9,500 circuit. So look very carefully. Do they give you all that power on one set of wires or plugs? I mean, this thing had three sets of plugs, and they were three sets of outputs, and they can't be connected because they're on different ways. They're not in synchronous ways. I don't know how you're going to find the efficiency. The guys who sell them don't really know. It's only the guys who run them know. Diesel. Diesel is the way to go, I think, long term. Diesel fuel stores well, it's not very volatile. Yes, you need plugs, sticky. The idle stage on diesel is excellent, and you get single cylinder diesels in small sizes. But I would go diesel because I can store a lot of diesel safely. But I don't know if the natural gas would be good unless, of course, you turn off the natural gas and save. Told me I've been long enough. I don't have much more to add than you can talk for hours, but I think that comes to my point.
Thank you very much, Jim. Don, good information. Now, I like the idea of the diesel being a very safe fuel. In my case, my number two fuel oil furnace on my house and my hot water heater with its 275-gallon tank, that would, if I had a way of tapping into it to power a generator, boy, I could run for a long period of time on that. However, the total number of diesel portable motor generator sets that we can buy down here in the United States is a fairly small number. It's a rather special buy. And maybe it's going to cost us some extra money. Maybe we've got to do a little bit of extra search on the internet to find a place like that, and then getting it shipped to you, because we're talking about a 150-pound machine in that order. There's various difficulties there. But still, Don, good information, Jim. Also, now, I'm about to turn it over to Dave at UAPG. I may have misquoted him, a gallon and a half for $24, but he's running the 1 kilowatt class of generator. It sips fuel, as he says it, and for him, supplying the right amount of gasoline for 24 hours was quite easy. So we'll correct some of my guesses there for Dave. And to APG, K2RAW and the Tech Man.
And QG's that full list at the end.
K2RW, and then this is M2APG. Good evening to everybody. Before I get into what I was going to tell you, as far as the fuel consumption on my 1,000-watt generator, it's more like a gallon of gas will give you about 6 to 8 hours of operation. That's the correct number. It certainly won't give you 24 hours. So a gallon will give you about 6 to 8 hours, and that may not be at full load. That might be at half load or something like that. Let me drop it. But that being said, it's still pretty economical. What I wanted to mention, before Mel goes out and buys a generator from Harbor Freight, they have a wonderful customer review section on their website. So when he goes to look at his 7-kilowatt generator that he might be considering to buy, if he looks carefully on that page where it shows him all the features of the generator, there'll be a little link that'll say something like, customer reviews, read the customer reviews. And because Harbor Freight is a nationwide company, there could be 1,000 or 2,000 customer reviews up on that website that he can look at. And there's some really, really good information in those customer reviews.
Thank you, Dave, and Bill recognized, going to be right after Joe, Don, good information. And let me repeat my wording on what Jim just told us, and that is you may have a 13-kilowatt generator, and if you're running it on 220-volt output, evenly balanced on both the A side and the B side, yes, you got 13 kilovolts. You could say it's a pair of 6 or 7 kilowatt 110-volt circuits, but it's not all on any one circuit. That's the bad news. The good news that Dave just brought to our attention is that even though you think you're running the house at a 1.5-kilowatt generator, and you think you're going to be drawing a 1.5 kilowatts, that's rare. In other words, the refrigerator, when you're running it, doesn't draw that much. The furnace might. The hot water heater probably doesn't, and so on. So as you cycle through these things, rarely are you at the maximum power. Another thing people worry about is what happens when you exceed the maximum power. Let me drop. If it was a generator built to Canadian standards, quite often they've got a circuit breaker in the output that trips, but almost all of the generators we buy do not have a circuit breaker. If you exceed, in other words, if your particular generator is good for, let me pick a number, 8 kilowatts, and you decide to draw 15 kilowatts from it, because of the drain you put, because of the load you put on the generator section, the motor senses the extra load, the torque requirement goes through the roof, and the motor simply stops. To my knowledge, most of the generators, when you overload them, they simply stop. You say, uh-oh, I goofed, and you go around the house and you start turning off a couple of the appliances because too many on or at once, and you go out and restart the generator. You also got to worry about somebody coming along and stealing the generator from you. There's been a couple of cases on Long Island where somebody came along with a beat-up old lawnmower, started the lawnmower in the middle of the night alongside of the guy's house, so he heard a motor running. Then he disconnected the guy's generator and stole it. So there's some crafty people out there. Get away about that. And now you're between a rock and a hard place, and having the generator close enough to the house that you can chain it to something so that people can't steal it, and get far enough away you're protecting yourself from carbon monoxide output. So, and how do you properly wire it into the house so that both halves of the house, your house really has an A circuit and a B circuit on 110 volts because there's 240 volts of, you know, split ground coming into your house. And how do you make sure that both sides of the house are operational? And do you use a long extension cord so that you wire just particular appliances, or do you backfeed the whole darn house so that everything is active when you turn it on? Lots of decisions to be made along those lines. Let's see what Joe's got to say. Some smart guys in Hicksville have been through the horror of Hurricane Sandy. Let's see how you survived it, Joe. W2BMP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. My only comment was that natural gas is not considered a continuous power source. In other words, I was just responding to a comment about using natural gas for a generator. We looked into that, and we were advised by the power authority that they have the right to shut down gas at any time at all, even before electricity, and during any major storm. They have their hands with the cutout natural gas. Just an FYI.